You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
In our passage today, Paul is driving home his message of equality by declaring that everyone who is led and moved by the Spirit are God's children. And because God is both Jesus and our parent, or Abba or Father, as Jesus says, then we are joint heirs with Christ. And as heirs, we have an inheritance. But this inheritance isn't a place or a gift or a reward. It's a relationship. And the best way Paul can describe that relationship is through the idea of our having been adopted. But with that status comes a lot of responsibility. It's not just something we are given at some point. It comes with accountability, here and now, for maintaining the family business, as it were. We are expected to jump in, and as the message version suggests, ask, what's next? What can we do?
Our words of wisdom are from Romans chapter 8, verses 15 through 17, the message version.
This resurrection life you received from God is not timid, grave-tending life. It's adventurously expectant, greeting God with a childlike, what's next? God's Spirit touches our spirits and confirms who we really are. We know who God is, and we know we are parent and children.
And we know we are going to get what's coming to us, an unbelievable inheritance. We go through exactly what Christ goes through. If we go through the hard times with him, then we're certainly going to go through the good times with him.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Once upon a time, there was a desperate man longing for guidance. He remembered someone saying that the Bible has all the answers. So he gets a Bible out and lets it fall open to a random page. Then, with eyes closed, he points his finger to the middle of the page. When he opens his eyes, his finger is pointing to Judas went and hanged himself. He thought, that couldn't be right. So he goes through the same procedure again, lets the book fall open, puts his finger in there, and this time the text reads, go thou and do likewise. Yikes. Not the greatest approach to Bible study. But what do you do when you're trying to determine God's will? We say it every time we recite the Lord's Prayer, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. But what exactly does that mean, really? Drop your finger on Paul's text in 1 Thessalonians, and you get a Christian bumper sticker. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Well, first off, all three of these commands, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, and give thanks for everything, are humanly impossible, and therefore not very helpful. Secondly, they're always taken completely out of context. They come in the middle of a long list of admonitions that Paul is giving in a closing paragraph that include, don't disrespect the prophets. Don't repay evil for evil. Respect one another. Help the weak. You know, the biggies. But you don't hear those mentioned as the will of God. They're conveniently skipped over. How about November of 1095 of the Common Era? Pope Urban II gave a lurid description of what he'd heard Muslims were doing to Christians in the Middle East and decreed to the people, "Enter upon the road to the Holy Sepulchre and wrest that land from the wicked race and subject it to yourselves." Legend has it that the miraculous unison response was, "It is the will of God! It is the will of God!" The First Crusade is what followed. It started with the persecution of Jews and ended with the slaughter of countless Muslims. Jerusalem fell in July of 1099. That's one version of God's will, isn't it? So let's see if we can get some clarification from the Lord's Prayer itself. In John Dominic Crossan's understanding, the will of God is the climax of the first half of the Lord's Prayer. As we've covered in the previous weeks, God's name is a reputation for justice and righteousness. That reputation is established insofar as God's kingdom is established. So God's kingdom of justice and righteousness being established is God's will. And we know where all this needs to take place because it's the next phrase, on earth as it is in heaven. In short, it implies heaven is in great shape. Thank you very much. Earth is where the problems are. In fact, the Greek is clearer than the English. As in heaven, so in earth. Heaven is the eternal model for the here and now, not some future destiny for good little boys and girls. So insofar as heaven comes down to earth, we're doing God's will. But we human beings have a hard time getting it. We love power over others. We love the way money and influence somehow makes us think we're smart. As Tevye sings in Fiddler on the Roof, "When you're rich, they think you really know." Then Maya Angelou really nails it when she says, "I find it interesting that the meanest life, the poorest existence, is attributed to God's will. But as human beings become more affluent, as their living standard and style begin to ascend the material scale, God descends the scale of responsibility." But Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3, "The wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight," and elsewhere notes that the wisdom of God is seen as foolishness in the eyes of the wise. I love the way Crossan interprets it. He writes, "What God sees as wisdom and power, this world sees as stupidity and weakness. What this world sees as wisdom and power, God sees as stupidity and weakness." Just listen to Psalm 82, where God speaks to the powers that be and bemoans their social malpractice. "How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the orphan. Maintain the right of the lowly and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked." But wait, the rulers say, "Come on, God. Don't be so naive. Everybody knows ruling is about power. Why bother with this justice thing? And that fair treatment is the right of the defenseless?" "Right. Not on my watch. I worked hard to get where I'm at, and I'm going to enjoy the comfort and security that comes with my fill in the blank. Political, economic, military power." God's response? Facepalm. "They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk around in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. What are the consequences of not doing this will of God? The very foundations of the earth are shaken. It's not a divine punishment, but simple human consequence. Crossan says, Zeus was a mighty god whose power was carried on the pikes of Alexander's phalanxes from Macedonia to India. Then one day, Zeus died. No one killed him. He just became irrelevant. Jupiter was a mighty god carried on the swords of Rome's legions from Britain to the Euphrates. Then one day, Jupiter too died. Nobody killed him. He simply became irrelevant. That's not divine punishment from some uber god. It's simply the very human consequence of failed rulers and a failed strategy, a failed set of values. So here it is. Gods of power die when the human power that supports them falters and fails. In other words, gods who promote power and violence as a way to get things done, get done in. And usually, not with a bang, but with a whimper. But what about a god of justice? A god whose identity, purpose, vision, and will is that of justice. Can a god of justice ever die? Only if the thirst for justice is extinguished from the heart of every human being. Our Romans passage tells us that we are children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God. It's up to us to either accept or reject our responsibility for God's world. In the end, this status as heirs of God is not about rewards, it's about responsibility. And if we fail to launch, it's not divine punishments we need to look out for, but plain old earthly consequences. It seems like it was a long time ago, but it was really only 7 years ago when our then president kicked off his tenure with not one, not two, but three Muslim bans that were accompanied, of course, with racist anti-Muslim rhetoric and all kinds of spurious generalized accusations. Not long after that, neo-Nazis marched in Charlottesville's Unite the Right rally. And in response, that same president declared that anti-Semitic protesters were actually very fine people. It's so important to remember that with all the other chaos, lies, and misdirection that has occurred since then, that this was actually the norm for a number of years. And to no one's surprise, it unleashed a surge of both anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic violence. But the news was not all bad. In response to the violence and racism, you could read headlines like, Jews rally around burned mosque, or learn that when headstones were vandalized in a Jewish cemetery in Missouri, Muslim benefactors raised $125,000 to pay for repairs. The day after the first Muslim ban in 2017, the Islamic Center in Victoria, Texas, was burned to the ground by a young man who is now serving a 24-year sentence for hate crimes. The pastor at the neighboring megachurch not only informed his congregation that Muslims may be our neighbors, but they're not our friends, he boycotted the interfaith prayer service at the site of the fire. However, members of the local Jewish congregation, who'd had a swastika graffitied on their synagogue years before, opened their house of worship for the Muslims to use while they were rebuilding their mosque. Long simmering anti-Semitism was percolating up everywhere. Do you remember? But even in the midst of it all, the hatred kept creating amazing opportunities for grace to occur. During that same time period, vandals toppled more than 100 headstones in a Jewish cemetery in Philadelphia. And what happened? Muslims and folks from other faiths traveled from surrounding states to help repair them. So even in the face of ignorance and bigotry, people of genuine faith continued to rise up in acts of compassion and solidarity. But the challenges remain. When my colleague Jeff Proctor Murphy got a call from their Jewish neighbors in Tempe, Temple Emmanuel, Dayspring jumped at the chance to host Emmanuel's Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur High Holy Day services. But as excited as Dayspring was to host their neighbors' High Holy Days, there was a sense of sadness when they learned how many other churches had turned the synagogue away with the excuse, "We won't allow people of another faith to use our facilities." So consider, how many steps is it from "we don't allow you in" to a Pope Urban-style call for the banning or destruction of a whole religion? How complicated is it, really, when faced with the claim that the wholesale slaughter of innocent Palestinian civilians in Gaza is justified as self-defense? And what does this have to do with committing ourselves to the will of God or taking seriously the claim, "Your will be done"? Well, it starts with having the courage to show someone who is different than you some respect, to not automatically dismiss them as irredeemable because they don't look, think, or pray like you. If you do, someone might say, "You're stupid for being gullible. So weak. Don't do it. Don't be vulnerable." Because plenty of people do see that as being stupid and weak. But let me ask you this. Can you be stupid for Jesus? Weak for Jesus? Be stupid welcoming. Be stupid vulnerable. And if you can be, then you can join me in the stupid and weak wing of the church, who for the last 150 years has allied ourselves with all the wrong people: women, child laborers, migrant workers, blacks, the poor, LGBTQ plus people, you know, the ones who are stupid, weak, and in many people's nightmares, dangerous. Why? Because at the core of God's will being done is the thirst for justice and the defense of the weak and vulnerable, no matter how hard the fight. I think many of you know that one of my spiritual heroes is the transcendentalist Theodore Parker. You've got to love a guy who is kicked out of the Unitarian Church for being too liberal. His writings have been influential to many, including Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. In fact, one of MLK's most oft-used encouragements to battered civil rights organizers is a paraphrase of Theodore Parker. "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." No matter how bad it seems, don't lose hope. Because, to paraphrase Crossan, humanity doesn't get away with injustice forever. Some of you know of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor who was executed for resisting the Nazis. In summarizing Bonhoeffer's work, his biographer, Eric Metaxas, says, "Being a Christian is less about cautiously avoiding sin than about courageously and actively doing God's will." Insofar as heaven comes down to earth, we're doing God's will. remembering to resist the temptation to give in to the gods of power and violence. When we say, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven," what we're talking about is proclaiming our allegiance to a God whose identity, purpose, vision, and will is that of justice and equality. For those of us who are followers of Jesus today, it means that we have to do everything possible to create relationships across divides of age, sex, gender identity, race, religion, and even political party. Because establishing this kingdom of God can happen only to whatever degree we courageously and actively do God's will. And in doing our part, we actually do what the Lord's Prayer says we aspire to, realizing the kingdom by doing God's will here and now. Be well. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.wepuTLoveFirst.org.